We're building that wall. We're building the wall. Don't worry. We've already started. We've already started.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And on Saturday evening, President Trump held a rally in Delaware, Ohio.
Instead of apologizing for America, we are standing up for America. We are standing up for the heroes who protect our country. Maxine. She's a real beauty. Maxine. A seriously low IQ person. A vote for Danny Boy and the Democrats is a vote to let criminals and drugs pour into our country and to let MS-13 run wild in our communities. And you know what they do once they're there. And we are proudly standing up for our national anthem. Thank you.
Trump was at Olentangy Orange High School to support Troy Balderson, a Republican state Senate candidate for the 12th district. But that's not what he focused on.
The Democrats are obstructionists. They are haters. They have tremendous hatred. They have tremendous hatred.
And some of what the president said was very upsetting.
In the sanctuary state of California, Air Force veteran Marilyn Ferris was viciously raped, murdered, and beaten to death with a hammer by an illegal alien with a long criminal history. Should have never been in our country.
This rally came 2 days after a rally in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And it followed another rally in Tampa, Florida, where, as usual, aggressive crowds heckled reporters while the president egged them on. The president's rallies are nothing new. Since November 2016, the president has held more than 24 rallies, many of them connected to 2018 midterm contests. But these rallies aren't merely political stunts. There's something darker going on here.
He actually has some impressive gut intuitions about how to activate collective emotions in his followers, especially moral emotions around anger and disgust. He's skilled at identifying common enemies and scapegoats and using those to rally the people in the audience who are there to support him.
This is something actually that has gone on in American history for 150 years, this desire of voters to attend rallies with national leaders and hear a sort of emotional speech.
Jeremy Young is an associate professor of history at Dixie State University and author of The Age of Charisma, Leaders, Followers, and Emotions in American Society, 1870 through 1940. I sat down with him and Jay Van Bavel, associate professor of psychology at New York University.
So what he's trying to do is build a common identity with these individuals and around his causes. And then what they're hoping to do usually is mobilize people. So mobilize them to vote in primary elections or general elections to get them to volunteer, donate money. Many of these people will feel energized after. This is common in political rallies. Now, by broadcasting these in the mainstream media, he's able to impact people around the country who are sitting at home as well. So he seems to be able to amplify his message very powerfully with these types of organized rallies.
And I'm wondering why Americans, and I'll pose this questions to both of you, why is it that this segment of the population, because these rallies are not attended by everybody, they're very much Trump's base, if you will, why this segment of the population is so whipped into a frenzy by largely what I would call hate messaging?
I think here Jay's point about the hate and the anger and disgust that is being whipped up at these rallies is very important, because while certainly there have been political rallies with emotional content in American history for a long time, it's been pretty rare that they have been so focused on othering people, on finding groups to blame things on, to create as scapegoats. And that is one of the things that we have to be careful of here, I think, is to identify the difference between a charismatic political rally used for good and a charismatic political rally that is used in dangerous ways. And the line between fascism and Martin Luther King is very slim in some ways. And one of the key differences is that someone like King, who uses this tool for good, is focusing on an uplifting message, focusing on some kind of concrete positive change, whereas someone like Trump is focusing on blaming problems on certain groups and whipping his followers into a frenzy about them.
And Jeremy, I want to go through a bunch of examples, but Jay, I'd love to hear your response to why hate is so effective in this environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've been analyzing Trump's language on Twitter, which is the other way that he gets his message out to people and creates a connection with them. And what we've found is that, first of all, among almost anybody, myself, yourself, Jeremy, is people who use moral emotional language like disgust, anger, or hate in their Twitter messages are more likely to have those messages go viral. So every single kind of moral emotional word increases the likelihood it's going to be a message will be shared or retweeted, you know, by 15 to 20%. When we analyzed Trump, he was off the charts. Not only does he use that language a lot, but when he uses it, it radically amplifies his message on Twitter. It's far more likely to go viral. Now, what we've also found is that when it goes viral, it only goes viral within echo chambers. So it's only among people who share your ideology on the left or right who tend to amplify those kind of tribal messages. And so he's basically using this language through multiple mediums, and it spreads. And it creates a sense of contagion, I think, of the emotion among the people who are hearing it, especially in a rally where you're surrounded by others and there's yelling and people are getting quite animated. But it tends to only work on people who are already committed to your cause. Now, to contrast it with somebody like Martin Luther King, what he was trying to send out was a universal message about universal values and principles and goals as a country, rather than just rally a subset of people who were supporting him. And so that is also consistent with what Jeremy was saying, is that one type of language tends to stay within your tiny group, and the other type of language is designed to draw in the broadest possible audience to support some kind of broader principle.
So I want to talk about some historical precedent. We've already talked about Martin Luther King as an example of sort of positive emotional rhetoric. There are a couple of other examples I want to get into there. But let's talk about some historical examples that are more in line with, you know, similar strategies to what the current president is using. And Jeremy, you suggested one example was, unfortunately, Adolf Hitler.
Absolutely. And I'm not the first historian to make that comparison either.
Mussten als Partei in der Minorität bleiben, weil wir die wertvollsten Elemente des Kampfes.
Hitler hammered away at what he called die Dolchstoß, the stab in the back, which was the idea that the political leaders of Germany in World War I, influenced in some nebulous way by Jews, had capitulated to the European powers and destroyed Germany. And these people were dead or out of power, and Hitler nevertheless went after them, hammer and tongs, and blamed them for everything that was going wrong in the state, even though it didn't really have anything to do with them.
And you also mentioned a speech by Huey Long from 1935 called Share the Wealth. Tell us about that.
Huey Long was a very interesting figure in American history. He was the governor of Louisiana, nominally a Democrat, but waged a sort of third-party attack on Franklin Roosevelt during the early years of the New Deal, arguing that Roosevelt, on the one hand, wasn't redistributing wealth enough, and on the other hand, wasn't taking enough power away from corporations. So in some ways, Long was a sort of left-wing fascist, if you will.
Over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat?
This speech is very interesting because of the way that Long draws on this type of angry emotional rhetoric to motivate followers to respond to it.
Jeremy, I'm wondering also, there are times when this hasn't happened, when political rhetoric has been used, as we mentioned with Martin Luther King more broadly. You also have a historical example of Ronald Reagan in a speech that he gave called A Time for Choosing. Tell us about that.
So Reagan's speech is in some ways it's the first speech that made Reagan a national political figure. It was the speech he gave at the 1964 Republican National Convention nominating Barry Goldwater for president, and it was really an extraordinary speech in which Reagan took the ideas of conservatism and distilled them into something that really made sense to people at an emotional level.
If you and I have the courage to tell our elected officials that we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right, we cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters.
And I think it's important here to keep in mind that people's desire to connect emotionally with their leaders isn't necessarily wrong. This is something that is that may be hardwired into human nature somehow. We see this 150 years ago and just as much as we see it today. And in fact, the idea that people will follow emotional speakers regardless of the facts is also an old idea. I was reading a speech recently from 1896 by a senator who was opposed to imperialism in America, and he attacks his opponents for engaging in what he calls false news. So this idea is not new. What is important here, I think, is that we can't cede the ground of emotion to people who want to use it for dangerous purposes. I think people all across the political spectrum are looking for this kind of emotional connection, and we need to be able to provide it for them. If we're concerned about the way it's being provided for them, we need to be able to provide it for them in a healthier way.
I'll just build on what Jeremy was saying. And so in psychology, there's a term called identity leadership. And I'll just tell you briefly, there was a study of political leaders running for office in Australia over many, many years. And they find that leaders who use collective pronouns like we, us, them, which is the other, are more likely to be elected than those who don't. And so that's an effective strategy for getting elected and rallying people and making them feel a connection with you. And so Trump is doing that. And I agree with Jeremy. What you need to do is realize that you don't want to cede that ground, that you just need an alternative vision of identity and someone who is good at making the case. And what I would say is that your identity needs to be broader. It needs to be around principles that are more encompassing of all citizens and can be more appealing to a wider segment of society. And so if you look at Trump's approval ratings, they've been pretty much stuck at 40% plus or minus 2 points for his entire presidency. What that means is there's a huge opportunity for somebody else with a broader message who can appeal to 60% of people. And so I think that, you know, instead of trying to appeal to a segment of society who's probably not going to move at all in terms of their opinions, try to encapsulate a broader segment of society under similar messages that can make them feel identified in a common sense of purpose and mobilize them to make positive change. So in that sense, I think there's a big opening for change in the coming elections.
Well, we'll see what happens with midterms right around the corner. That's Jay Van Bavel, Associate Professor of Psychology at New York University, and Jeremy Young, Assistant Professor of History at Dixie State University. Thank you both so much for your insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.